Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
The man who hacked elections, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Colombian hacker says he manipulated elections all over Latin America. This reporter asked him if the same thing's happening in the U.S.
He said, think about what's at stake for the presidency of the United States of America. He said, you're kidding yourselves if you think there aren't swarms of people like me doing this same type of work.
Also, China's state media says April Fool's jokes are inconsistent with core socialist values. The reaction from Chinese internet users?
Basically saying, since you can't believe Chinese state media, every day is in fact April Fool's Day.
Plus, the American concert pianist who moved to the edge of a canyon in Mexico.
I feel like I'm part of nature. It's utter bliss.
Those stories today on The World. Happy Friday to you. You know, sometimes it's hard to tell if art is imitating life or life is imitating art. Take our first story today. It reminded me of a recent feature film, Our Brand is Crisis. That's about foreign campaign strategists getting a candidate in Bolivia elected to the presidency there by any means necessary. Here's a scene where the candidate, played by Joaquin de Almeida, and the consultant, Sandra Bullock, are in a serious disagreement over campaign strategy.
Let me make this clear to you. Please. I am the one in charge. Do you understand?
No. See, you're not in charge.
What did you just say?
Maybe nobody's in charge. Maybe we're all just rolling down a hill and there's no one at the wheel. I don't know. Sir, why can you not say what you're supposed to say?
Where's because I'm
problem?
Not just a puppet
of
for you to play
you
with.
Of course you are. Of course you're a puppet.
Today we're hearing that there may have been lots of puppets and not fictional ones. Bloomberg is out with a story about election rigging across Latin America and maybe beyond that's getting a lot of attention, all courtesy of one man now behind bars who's talking about what he did. Reporter Jordan Robertson joins us now from Bloomberg's Washington newsroom. Tell us about the hacker at the center of the Bloomberg investigation who's making some pretty big allegations.
Sure, he is. His name's Andres Sepulveda. He's a 31-year-old Colombian hacker. He's in jail. He's in prison 2 years into a 10-year sentence for hacking related to the 2014 presidential elections in Colombia. We began speaking with him about 9 months ago in prison interviews. And the story that he tells, which we've been able to, you know, validate to our satisfaction, you know, many pieces of it, is one that he, you know, had aligned with a top Latin American political strategist named J.J. Rendon. And for 8 or 9 years, you know, was hacking on behalf of presidential campaigns throughout Latin America, Colombia, Mexico, Venezuela, and others. And it's almost an unbelievable tale until you think about what's at stake in some of these campaigns. And it's cliche, but, you know, information is power. And that was the currency that he trafficked in.
His biggest revelation is that he helped rig the Mexican election in 2012 that brought Enrique Peña Nieto to power and returned his pre-party to power after 12 years out of government. That one really seemed to suggest how deep into the dirty tricks playbook Sepulveda was reaching. Specifically, what did Sepulveda allege he did in the Mexican election? Like, sure. How do you hack a campaign?
Very simply, a lot of people, and this was another surprise for us too, when we started reporting this, we assumed it was hacking the voting machines, hacking the ballot box. It's, you know, the modern day equivalent of stuffing the ballot box. And he said that wasn't really his focus. His focus was espionage, was intelligence gathering. And that means exclusively almost, you know, attacking the top strategists of the candidates. And I recall a funny conversation we had with him where we're like, well, how focused were you on the candidates themselves? And he just laughed. He's like, the candidates don't know anything. Their strategists know everything. And information was power. And that information was then fed into, according to Sepulveda, you know, the pre-campaign to help both the presidential election as well as governors and mayors and all sorts of other local elections. That's the key, but also social media manipulation as well, influencing people's opinion based on that hacked information and exploiting vulnerabilities that these campaigns know they have, sensitive issues that they don't really want out there, but doing it in a way that it seems authentic, an authentic expression of regular people.
Did Sepulveda give you evidence proving he kind of staged these misinformation campaigns?
He did. You know, that was the funny part of all this is we spent months interviewing him, hearing his story, and then we reached a point where after we'd peeled back the layers of the onion, we said, all right, well, what now? How do we make this a story that we could actually publish? How do we prove that any of this is remotely even true? And it turned out Sepulveda had kept what he calls an insurance file, a secret insurance file, you know, on his former boss, J.J. Rendon, and, you know, many of their communications. And these were emails that, you know, they had both, he was supposed to have deleted, but he didn't. So we got, you know, maybe a dozen or a dozen and a half, you know, emails, the original emails, which we had analyzed by a cybersecurity company to validate their authenticity, you know, showing what J.J. Rendon and his consulting firm insist never happened, which was, you know, extensive communication about political hacks, hacking of government websites, targeting of, you know, key strategists in the Mexican presidential race. You know, there are certain things we couldn't validate, you know, details that only Andres sitting in the room alone would know. But the core of the story, which is this was a guy who was hacking, you know, for political campaigns from, you know, at least 2005 until, you know, 2014, that has been proven to our satisfaction. And the fact that he's sitting in prison now for, you know, hacking the Colombian presidential race, it actually gives him a lot of credibility in that regard.
Well, you've published the story, but President Enrique Peña Nieto's government denies what Sepulveda is alleging. So does J.J. Rendon, the political operative who was supposed to have hired Sepulveda. So who's telling the truth?
You know, it's funny. We saw the Peña Nieto, you know, denial, and he was very technical. He said, you know, we deny ever hiring, you know, Andres Sepulveda. And we would point out that all of the campaign work was done by, you know, operatives or supporters of the PRI. So he's very clearly pointing his finger at his political party, which amusingly says that, you know, they don't know J.J. Rendon. On his own website, he's got the Peña Nieto campaign as kind of, he highlights it as a capstone, you know, of his achievements. So it's, you know, we're very satisfied with the information we have. There was a pretty deep relationship there between J.J. Rendon and Andres Sepulveda, and you put the pieces together and, you know, there was a lot of hacking going on. It's much more like espionage.
When you asked Andres Sepulveda, is the U.S. election being rigged? He said 100% for sure.
100%. He's like, think about some of his campaigns were for very small countries in Latin America. He said, think about what's at stake for the presidency of the United States of America. He said, there is no, with so much power at stake. He said, you're kidding yourselves if you think there aren't swarms of people like me, you know, doing the same type of work.
Does he have evidence that this is happening in the 2016 campaign?
He doesn't, but we've talked to some other cybersecurity consultants who say they've been approached for all manner of these types of jobs. You know, whether there's somebody exactly like him, who knows? But this work is absolutely happening because knowing where a candidate's going, knowing who he's meeting with, knowing what he's going to say next, knowing what his next policy speech is going to be, as we saw in Mexico, you know, I mean, that's really powerful information to have.
How do you think your reporting is going to affect the political life of Mexico under Peña Nieto now?
Oh, it's a very good question. We've been watching with a lot of attention to this because clearly Peña Nieto's camp wants to have nothing to do with J.J. Rendon or clearly this hacker. It'll be very interesting to see how the political party, the PRI, responds because their initial comment was, we don't know anything about J.J. Rendon. J.J. Rendon said, I've worked for you 16 plus years, including now. You know, how these types of consultants, you know, have been integrated into the system, I think is going to get a really hard look in Mexico and elsewhere, because even if you have plausible deniability, you know, what does that mean for the system when something like this happens and it comes out? It's a very serious, you know, allegation and claim, you know, that Sepulveda is making and has been able to back up, you know, to a large degree. So, you know, tampering with the process in this way is a new way of doing it. It's not stuffing ballot boxes. So it's a little bit harder to conceptualize. But, you know, we're hoping that through reporting like this, people can see that, you know, the bad old days are still there. They just have computers now. And, you know, this is an example and a great jumping off point to start discussing that.
Bloomberg reporter Jordan Robertson in Washington, thanks very much for telling us about what you and the Bloomberg team discovered here.
Thanks so much for your interest.
This next story is about another kind of hacking, this one aimed at China's president, Xi Jinping. Last month, an anonymous letter popped up on a state-backed website in China. The letter was there long enough to seriously rattle the authorities in China. They've been rounding people up, trying to figure out who wrote the letter and who distributed it. And they've been detaining relatives of dissidents living outside China to get answers. Mary Kay Magstad is the world's former China correspondent, now host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? Mary Kay, this was a short but provocative letter. What did it say?
Well, among other things, it called on Xi Jinping to resign. It mentioned more than once in the letter that, you know, the safety of his family might be imperiled if he didn't. It said that his cult of personality was pulling the country in the wrong direction. He was abusing power, and that this was just bad for the party and bad for the country.
And officials think Xi Jinping might be trolled from outside China?
Well, the letter was signed by loyal members of the Communist Party. And it's anyone's guess whether it was actually written by loyal members of the Communist Party, by senior members of the Communist Party, or by dissidents inside China or outside China. I mean, Xi is clearly spooked by this enough that he's going after even family members of a journalist who's in exile in Germany.
Well, I mean, that is kind of the surprising thing, that this letter would get posted on a state-backed website. What do you think that means? Does it suggest an inside job?
It could. You know, look, the party has never been monolithic, certainly not in the last 20, 30 years. There are certainly factions within the party, officials who had, as recently as a few years ago, thought that moving in a more pluralistic direction was a good thing for the country and actually even for the party, and that having a higher level of democracy within the party was a good first step. Xi has sort of reversed that trend and has amassed a lot of power in his own hands and has made it clear to members of the party that he doesn't really appreciate criticism even from them. In January, he said that party members should really refrain from criticizing his positions. And he told the media in China that their job is to be the mouthpiece of the party. And some journalists have actually resigned because they said, you know, that's not how I got into this. That's not what I want to do.
Mary Kay, when you lived in China and a provocative dissident flare like this was launched, was there a pattern the central government would follow in dealing with dissent like this?
Right. Well, so again, we don't know that this is a dissident flare.
Right.
We know that the letter was put out there and we don't know who wrote it. So if it came from within the party, this is startling and it's, you know, sort of unprecedented within the last 30 years of, you know, sort of reform and opening up. When I lived in China in the 90s and in the early 2000s, there were different times when there would be a push for more pluralism. I mean, I remember in the 90s, there was actually an opposition party that operated for 6 months in 1998, openly, before the government clamped down and jailed the leaders of it. Mm. There have been other times, you know, certainly with the advent of Weibo, China's version of Twitter, which started in 2009, more and more people started expressing more and more opinions online and even using Weibo as a way to whistleblow, to say, hey, this local official is acting badly and this needs attention. And the central government would actually react and would respond. And in some ways, early on, saw that as being sort of a useful tool in governance. But when Xi Jinping came to power, he saw this as a threat. He saw this as, you know, if you have all these voices who are criticizing us and who are suggesting we should be doing things differently, we're losing control. And who knows where this could lead.
In one of your recent podcasts, Mary Kay, you talked about authoritarianism in China and how it's not necessarily a bad word there among ordinary Chinese.
Yeah, well, so particularly in the 90s, but even going into the last decade or so, when I was in China, people would say, you know, we need to have a strong government because if we don't have a strong government, we'll have chaos, and that would be bad. We've had a history of chaos. We know what that feels like. As long as the government is competent and as long as it mostly leaves us alone to live our lives, we're good. I did also talk to people who expressed a desire to have more pluralism, a system that was more fair, more freedom of speech, etc. But at least as often and probably more often, I heard people say, well, you know, I mean, in China, we have our, you know, sort of special situation, and so we need a government that can hold everything together. I also heard urban dwellers say, you know, if we had democracy, that means farmers would vote, and, you know, what do they know?
Mary Kay, always great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Great to speak with you too, Marco. Thanks.
The world's former China correspondent Mary Kay Magsad there. Her podcast is called Whose Century Is It? Two recent episodes are all about the issue of authoritarianism around the world, including right here in the U.S. So take a listen. You can find it at pri.org/whosecentury. And stick around. Later on the show, China's official news agency says no to April Fools. But was that a joke? Here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The Vikings sure were busy 1,000 years ago. They raided their way across Europe. They went farther afield, too, into modern-day Turkey and Canada. And now there is preliminary evidence that they may have ventured farther south into North America than previously thought, all the way into southern Newfoundland. Sarah Parkak is a space archaeologist at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. She's found evidence of what may be a second Viking settlement in North America using satellite images. And we should note that her research is funded in part by our partners at the BBC and NOVA here at WGBH. Sarah, you do a very specialized kind of archaeology using WorldView 3, a commercial satellite that peers down at Earth with infrared technology. So what did you see in those pictures that made you think, huh? Vikings, probably.
Well, we definitely did not think it could be Norse initially, and we're still being really cautious and really careful because if this is a Norse site, the potential is tremendous and the work is still ongoing. We initially scanned the coastline of eastern Canada and into northern New England using open source Google Earth imagery. If we'd gotten high resolution satellite imagery for that entire area, it would have probably cost tens of millions of dollars. Mm. But once we saw what looked like anomalies or hotspots, then we ordered the high-resolution satellite imagery and did processing. And when we initially did the analyses, what we thought we were seeing could potentially be a historic site or an indigenous Native North American site rather than Norse. I thought, what are the chances that we could actually potentially find a new Norse site?
So you led this team that excavated the site in southern Newfoundland. What did you find?
So when we excavated last summer, we excavated a hearth with about 18 pounds of bog iron. We found what looks like turf structures. And we know that historic peoples and most indigenous Native North Americans did not build using turf.
So all of this, it suggests Vikings once you saw it?
So when we were excavating, you know, we had thought we would find evidence of settlers from England or from France or indigenous groups. And when we were excavating, you know, we found no ceramics. We also didn't find any flints. Mm. And typically when you're excavating an indigenous site in Newfoundland, you find flints. So all the data put together suggests that the site could potentially be Norse.
So I know some of your colleagues are skeptical. What do you need to find still that would make this possible Viking settlement a lock?
I very much welcome that skepticism. You know, I've been very skeptical from the word go. And you have to look at what archaeologists did working on the site of Lonsdale Meadow, which is the only known and accepted Norse site in North America and the northern tip of Newfoundland. They had to excavate there for over 3 years. So when we go back this summer, we need to collect a lot more evidence for dating. You know, it would be wonderful to get an object that shows that the site is definitely Norse. And also, we need a lot more evidence of ironworking. And if we find all those things, then I think people will be a lot less skeptical.
So this would be the second site if it is confirmed that this is a Viking site. Why is that important?
So I think when you look at Lonsdale Meadow, which was found over 50 years ago, you can explain away one site. You know, it's a one-off. It's one place they tried to stay for a short amount of time and then they would have left. But I think if there's two, there's definitely more.
Archaeologist Sarah Parkak, her and her team's discovery of a second possible North American Viking village is featured in a NOVA documentary airing on PBS next week. Sarah, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here's some good news, especially if you like nuts. The lifting of U.S. sanctions on Iran might mean American consumers will be able to get Iranian pistachios. I sampled some on my trip to Tehran 2 months ago, even brought back a kilo, and they didn't last very long. Iranian pistachios have a well-deserved reputation as the best in the world. Israelis love them too, but the Iranian kind are not easy to find there or legal to sell in Israel. We sent Daniel Estrin on a Persian nut hunt in Jerusalem.
Machane Yehuda is the main Israeli food market in Jerusalem, and it really is a feast for the eyes. spices and pastries and halva and fruits and vegetables, all of them piled into small market stalls. This is where you go when you're looking for an exotic ingredient. And it's where I went on the hunt for Iranian pistachios. I walked into the Hamami nut shop in a side alleyway and met co-owner Yaron Hamami. Persian pistachios are the best, he told me. I'm Persian, I know. But it's illegal. There's nothing you can do about it. Hamami belongs to Israel's Iranian Jewish community, and he misses the taste of an Iranian pistachio. It's considered a delicacy. People in Israel go crazy for pistachios. But he says it's against Israeli law to import them from enemy countries. He told me he knows someone who tried to import Iranian pistachios about a year ago, but they were confiscated at Israel's main port. He brought it in through Turkey, Hamami says. He didn't write it was from Iran. They caught him. Here was my big reveal. I told Hamami that last week I spotted his competitor, a nut seller the next alleyway over, advertising a sack of Persian pistachios. You know what Hamami said? Those aren't Persian. They're Greek. You think I was tricked? I asked. Yeah, he says. How do you know whether it's Persian or not? So I decided to go to that nut cellar to get some. There they were, a small sack on the ground at the front. And inside the sack, a small yellow sign in handwritten Hebrew that read, Persian pistachio, special taste. I asked the merchant how he gets his Iranian pistachios, and he quickly ended our conversation. So I bought 200 grams and walked over to a third nut stand, Kahana Nuts. There, a man in the back was stirring trays of watermelon seeds and shoving them in the oven for roasting. I asked a guy at the front if they sold Iranian pistachios. He said, no, it's illegal. So then I told him his neighbor had just sold me some. They can't be Iranian, they're probably Turkish, he said. Then the watermelon seed roaster piped up. His name's Mohammed Shahada. He's Palestinian. Let me see, he said, asking to look in the bag. It only took him a moment before he said, this is Persian. It's not Persian, the Israeli guy said. It's Persian. Persian mixed with some American, the Palestinian roaster said. It's not Persian, the Israeli said again. I've been doing this for 30 years. I know more than they do, the Palestinian said. He said he was willing to bet on it. He proceeded to dump my small bag of pistachios into a red plastic bin. He separated out a few American nuts mixed in. They're bigger and lighter colored and a bit pointier. The Israeli supervisor walked over and peeked, and he said, you know, you may be right. So I called Gil Feiler, an expert in Israeli trade with the Middle East, and he told me Iranian pistachios do make their way to Israel via Turkey. To try to stop this, Israel began imposing a tax on pistachios from Turkey, and importers must prove their nuts are Turkish-sourced. But then I talked to a major Israeli pistachio importer, Vered Musafi, and she insisted that absolutely no Iranian nuts make it into Israel at all, so as not to support the enemy. This was proving to be a hard nut to crack. But I can tell you one thing. The alleged Iranian pistachios I bought were not as tasty and as crunchy as the California ones. Turns out pistachio trees in Iran have been suffering because of a major drought. Maybe these coveted nuts are not what they used to be. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Jerusalem.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and thousands of Americans traveled to Spain in the late 1930s to fight in that country's civil war, including a young couple from Kentucky.
She was the live wire of the two, and she said to her somewhat older, somewhat stodgier husband, we have to go to Spain and see what this revolution is like.
Their story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I remember Barack Obama's first speech at the UN General Assembly, an urgent appeal to the world to step up efforts to safeguard nuclear materials, reduce the risk of nukes and radioactive material getting into the hands of terrorists and rogue nations. Nuclear security became quietly a centerpiece of his administration's security strategy. This week, the president's hosted an international summit to review progress. So just how well has he and the rest of the world done to keep us safe? Matthew Bunn co-authored a report that came out last week entitled Preventing Nuclear Terrorism. Bunn's a professor at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Thanks for being with us again, Matthew. Remind us where we were in 2009. How bad was the problem with loose nukes and radioactive materials when Obama took office?
Well, the key gap when he took office was that there wasn't really any international forum to discuss nuclear security at a high level. It was being handled by bureaucrats. And what he did with the summit process is he raised it to the level of presidents and prime ministers. It has really transformed the international debate about nuclear security, greatly heightened the attention that countries are giving to nuclear security. And it's led to real action on the ground, the elimination of highly enriched uranium from quite a number of countries, increases in security for nuclear materials, and so on. Aren't we all glad, for example, that there wasn't any more highly enriched uranium in Ukraine when the fighting started?
How did Obama see the American role in actually wrangling all this nuclear stuff out there in the world?
Well, I think Obama saw a need for American leadership to overcome the complacency that people had that said, oh, terrorists couldn't possibly do these things, or, oh, well, you know, maybe some other country has a problem, but my security is fine. And I think there is still a need to push to overcome that kind of complacency, because often if you're running a nuclear facility, you've been running it that way for the last 30 years and haven't had a problem, and you think, well, why should I change my security measures? And the answer to that question is the threat is evolving, even compared to 2 years ago at the last summit. Then when the director of national intelligence was testifying to Congress about the threats facing the country, he didn't even mention the Islamic State. And within months, they had seized major portions of Iraq and Syria. Now, before this summit, we know that Islamic State operatives involved in the Paris attacks and the Brussels attacks were monitoring a nuclear official of a Belgian nuclear facility with enough highly enriched uranium for several nuclear weapons.
Yeah, well, we're going to hear about those incidents in Belgium in a few minutes. So overcome the complacency. You believe terrorists have the capacity to go nuclear right now?
Not right now, but we have repeated government studies that have concluded that it is plausible that a sophisticated terrorist group, if it could get hold of the highly enriched uranium or the plutonium, could make at least a crude nuclear bomb capable of incinerating the heart of a major city. And we don't have hard evidence that the Islamic State is pursuing nuclear or radiological weapons yet, but we see these troubling indicators from the events in Belgium. And if they did turn nuclear, they've got more money, more people, more territory under control to work in, and more ability to recruit experts globally than al-Qaeda at its strongest ever had.
Since it was Obama who kind of moved this issue into a brighter light, if you were to grade Obama on it, on nuclear security, what would you give him as a grade?
Well, you know, an official said years ago that this is something that seems kind of pass-fail. Either you prevent nuclear terrorism or you don't.
That's a good point.
So far, we have succeeded in preventing it, and we have reduced the risk a lot over the years compared to what it once was. On the other hand, I think that progress has slowed over the course of the last couple of years. In our study, we concluded that while nuclear security has improved somewhat over the last 2 years since the last summit, the capabilities of terrorists have increased dramatically over that time. So in the net, it may be that the risk of nuclear terrorism is higher than it was 2 years ago.
Matthew Bunn at Harvard's Belfer Center, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we heard, one place where nuclear security is a real concern right now is Belgium. The country's already on edge after the recent bomb attacks that killed more than 30 people. The New York Times' Alyssa Rubens just returned to Paris from Brussels. She's been writing about nuclear security. I don't think of Belgium as a loose nukes kind of place, Alyssa. What makes it so vulnerable?
There are a variety of different issues. One of them is that Belgium has not, for some years, had the same level of security around its nuclear installations, although it's improved it a lot in the last couple of years. There's a feeling now, I think, in the nuclear security community that there's almost no way to have too much security, partly because there are now terrorist groups that are quite interested in potentially obtaining either radioactive material or even nuclear material, such as highly enriched uranium or plutonium.
And is it a concern that ISIS-affiliated terrorists would want highly enriched uranium to turn into a bomb, or that they actually want to just cut off one of Belgium's main sources of power?
Well, I think you have to disaggregate a bit the different issues. Power plants are probably vulnerable primarily to sabotage, and that would be very frightening for people. Potentially, if they had a large enough bomb, they could cause a Fukushima-type incident.
In other words, you're saying a bomb that would target one of those nuclear plants.
Target, right. So people would, for instance, get a badge, or several people get guards' badges, or they would force their way into the plant and then detonate some sort of bomb that would injure the plant. So that's one scenario. But Belgium also has a research reactor, which uses highly enriched uranium. And that is the material that you would use for making an atomic weapon. And if that could be stolen, which would be complicated, but probably not impossible, it could then be made into a sort of ad hoc nuclear device as opposed to a dirty bomb.
How likely is that?
A huge risk. I don't think it's very likely, but I think no one is satisfied with not very likely as a, sort of the threshold. I think people would like to make it almost completely impossible. ISIS has the money and the range of contacts that if it wanted to find nuclear scientists, I think it probably could, who would be willing to help them put one together using the material.
Yeah, I gather there's some skepticism as to ISIS's capabilities of building like a suitcase nuke, more likely that they'd build some kind of dirty bomb. But as far as sabotage at one of these reactors, that already happened in November of 2014. Tell us what did go down and how dangerous it was.
A person who had access, they still don't know who, to the oil, which is used to keep lubricating all of the cooling systems and the other systems that kind of diffuse the enormous heat that is generated by a nuclear power plant, they drained off all the oil so that the cooling systems didn't work. And so what happened was that the plant shut down. And that person seems to have at least had some insider access in order to do that.
Right. I mean, there were also a couple of nuclear plant workers elsewhere who left the plant and joined ISIS. So that combined with the failure to zero in on the perpetrators of the Paris attacks and then the Brussels attacks, there seem to be reasons to be worried about the capacity of the Belgian police. What are they doing to beef up security?
They've done a few things when it comes to the nuclear installations. They are putting specially trained guards. I'm not clear entirely about whether they'll be special police units or soldiers, but they will be tasked with really guarding the facilities because there's always an external threat to a nuclear facility and an internal one.
The New York Times' Alyssa Rubin in Paris, just back from Brussels. Thanks a lot, Alyssa.
Thank you.
In the late 1930s, nearly 3,000 Americans crossed the Atlantic and took up arms against Francisco Franco and the rising fascism in Spain. 700 of them, known as the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, died for the cause. Here's author Adam Hochschild.
One young American volunteer, Maury Colau of New York, later said, "For us, it was never about Franco. It was always about Hitler." Another 23-year-old Hyman Katz, who was actually a young rabbi, wrote to his mother several months before he was killed in Spain, saying that if he had not come to Spain, forever afterwards he would never have forgiven himself for not having woken up when the alarm clock rang.
Hochschild's new book is called Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 39. One story he tells is about an American couple who went to see what Hochschild calls the most widespread social revolution ever seen in Europe.
Workers took over factories, including the Ford and General Motors auto plants in Barcelona. Waiters took over restaurants. Mm. Peasants took over these large estates. Locomotive engineers took over the railway system. Nothing like it had ever happened before. At that time, traveling in France and Germany was this young American couple, Lois and Charles Orr. She was 19 years old, a student at the University of Louisville, Kentucky. A few months earlier, she had married an economics instructor at the university, a little bit older than she. They were honeymooning. She was the live wire of the two, and she said to her somewhat older, somewhat stodgier husband, "We have to go to Spain and see what this revolution is like." Mm. So they hitchhiked to the Spanish border, arriving 2 months after the coup, crossed, and for the next 10 months lived in revolutionary Barcelona. This was – this social revolution I spoke of was an aspect of things that was really almost totally ignored by the hundreds and hundreds of foreign correspondents who were in Spain at this time. Lois and Charles Orr lived it. Lois described it at great length in a remarkable series of letters home.
Yeah, I mean, tell us about those letters, because there's some fascinating stuff in there. What did she say in those letters?
They were excited that here was a revolution that seemed to be bubbling from the ground up and not one that was imposed from the top down as it happened in the Soviet Union. They hung out with other foreign idealists in Barcelona who had come there to work for this revolution. One of the people in their circle, for example, was a 23-year-old political refugee from West Germany named Willy Brandt, who later, of course, became chancellor of West Germany. Mm. And Lois described what it was like living in a hotel where these foreign volunteers were housed, where all the food was free. Wine had been confiscated from the cellars of the rich. There was very little exchange of money because the anarchists, who were the ones who were really running this revolution, didn't believe in money. And everything was done on a barter system. It really was something quite remarkable that was going on, and she left the most extensive eyewitness account by any American.
You say, though, Orr and her husband did not seem to have paid much attention to a disturbing part of the history they were living through. Can you explain that?
What happened in Spain at this time was extremely violent on both sides. The nationalists, when they staged their coup, were absolutely ruthless in terms of political murder. And indeed, over the course of the Spanish Civil War, they deliberately killed some 150,000 civilians and another 20,000, it's estimated, afterwards. On the side of the Spanish Republic, there were also a lot of political murders, less as a matter of the Republic's policy than of mobs that got out of control and nobody was able to stop them. Some 49,000 nationalist sympathizers or presumed nationalist sympathizers were killed in the territory of the Spanish Republic. Lois and Charles Orr seemed only dimly at best aware of this. Most of the killing had stopped by the time they'd gotten there, but it still is a bloody background to this period.
So despite Lois Orr's embrace of global revolution, in the end, did she and her husband think they were starry-eyed and out of their depth?
Here's what happened to that social revolution. There was considerable tension in the Spanish Republic between the mainstream parties and the Communist Party on one side, who felt not unreasonably that to fight against an insurgent army backed by Hitler and Mussolini, you needed a strong army under a centralized command. At the same time, there were the anarchists and the smaller left-wing parties affiliated with them who believed that only if you had a social revolution would Spaniards be energized enough to want to defend the Spanish Republic. Mm. Eventually, these two forces came to blows. Several hundred people were killed in May of 1937 in Barcelona, and the Communist Party and its mainstream allies really established their dominance in the Republic's government. At that point, Lois Orr, like many of the anarchist sympathizers, felt that the anarchist leaders had sold out by agreeing to abandon their revolutionary attempts while the war was on. She and other foreign supporters were briefly arrested, but she and her husband were let go after about 10 days and made to leave the country.
The people we hear about today who volunteer to fight are largely the disaffected youth in Europe and the U.S. joining ISIS. ISIS would say, yeah, we've got a revolution. It's an important cause. Was that in the back of your mind as you wrote this book?
No, because I think throughout history, you've got examples where sizable number of peoples have left one country to go to some other country or some other part of the world to fight for a cause they believed in. sometimes for religious reasons, the Crusades, sometimes for political reasons. Thousands of people from Europe came to fight with Simón Bolívar in the early 19th century for independence in Latin America. Lafayette came here to help fight for American independence. People from England and elsewhere went to Greece in the early 1800s to fight for Greek independence, and Lord Byron died there. Mm. So throughout history, people have been going places to fight for religious or political causes that they believe in. Looking back after many decades, I think it's a little easier for us to pass judgment on whether those causes were worth fighting for or not. I think the cause of a democratic Spain was worth fighting for, and in that sense, I would put it in a very different category than the people who are going to volunteer to fight for ISIS today.
Adam Hochschild's fascinating new book is called Spain in Our Hearts. Adam, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Marco. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to The World. If you want to make a joke in China, don't do it today. The Chinese state news agency Xinhua warned its readers against any funny business this April 1st. April Fool's Day, they said, quote, is inconsistent with core socialist values. So are they joking? For more answers, I called up David Wertheim. He's senior editor for Foreign Policy's China section, Tea Leaf Nation. So was that an April Fool's joke, David, or not?
The truth is it's impossible to know. There is a grand and old tradition in China of satirizing the powers that be in extraordinarily subtle ways. And it's possible that that's what this is. The other alternative, and the more sort of straight alternative, is that the Post does mean what it says and that someone decided to take it on themselves to remind readers that April Fool's Day, you know, should not be seen as an opportunity to spread the kinds of jokes, for example, directed at the leadership, directed at Xi Jinping, whose image is tightly managed at all times.
Well, as we heard earlier in the program today, you don't joke about Xi Jinping. If it is just, you know, Xinhua being tough on people and joking around on April 1st, there's been quite a response online. Share some of what you've been seeing.
The response online has not been very favorable. Then again, Xinhua has let stand on its Weibo page, sort of a devastating joke in which a commenter notes that the Western calendar itself is, of course, Western and therefore does not comport with Chinese tradition. Hmm. And so it might be better simply to declare the year 2016 as year three of Papa Xi, which is slang for Xi Jinping. Other posts have reacted rather negatively to this, basically saying, since you can't believe Chinese state media, every day is, in fact, April Fool's Day.
Well, the Chinese press itself has been fooled on days other than April 1st. Maybe we can have a little fun at their expense for a moment. Several incidents where newspapers there have picked up stories from The Onion as fact.
Yes, that's happened on at least two occasions. In June of 2002, state-linked Beijing Evening News thought that an Onion piece reporting that the U.S. Congress was threatening to move the Capitol from D.C. unless the Capitol were upgraded ran it as fact, and they refused to issue a retraction. In November 2012, People's Daily, the state mouthpiece, ran a 55-page feature on Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator, using quotes from The Onion after it had declared Kim the sexiest man alive. It later removed that link. So these are some examples of Chinese state media perhaps not having the same ear for humor that you would see elsewhere.
Well, sometimes fact is better than fiction. Sometimes the reverse is true, isn't it?
And sometimes you can't tell which is which.
David Wertheim, editor for Foreign Policy's Tea Leaf Nation. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Okay, our final story today sounds like an April Fool's joke, but I assure you it isn't. It's about an American concert pianist who took his one-ton grand piano to the very edge of Mexico's renowned Copper Canyon. Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe tells us why he did it.
The short route to Romaine Wheeler's cliffside home in Mexico's Copper Canyon is on a 5-passenger charter plane. From the air, it looks like a glass cocoon at the edge of a canyon wall. The landing strip is carved into a rocky mesa, flanked by a handful of adobe homes and their tiny cornfields. On this sunlit morning, Wheeler comes out to greet the pilot and a couple of awestruck reporters. He's 74, a classically trained pianist with light skin and blue eyes. His looks scream outsider, but his feet, caked in dirt and strapped in rubber sandals, look no different than the feet of the local Tarahumara Indians. An orphaned goat cries for milk inside Wheeler's home. He took it in after its mother slipped off the canyon rim. Like the goat, Wheeler is an adopted son of this landscape. He came here 30 years ago after reading about it in National Geographic. Now he's fulfilled his dream of uniting his love of the outdoors with his passion for music.
I feel like I'm part of nature, and when I'm composing or writing, things flow very naturally without me having to look for them. It's utter bliss.
When he plays, Wheeler is like a bear on the piano bench. His fingers tumble across the keys like a river over boulders. This song he composed to honor his favorite cottonwood tree. Its style is similar to native Tarahumara music, like this dance for violin and guitar. To get his concert grand into this rugged sierra, Wheeler hauled it in a dump truck, cushioned with 4 tons of potatoes. The potatoes were also the payment for his 28 Tarahumara assistants. Today, the piano sits in Wheeler's home, overlooking a spectacular panorama of mountains. He rehearses here and continues to give concerts worldwide. His earnings go to a nonprofit he started, which funds scholarships for kids and pays a nurse to staff a clinic he helped build.
There's such a high mortality rate in the children in the remote parts of the canyons here. In some places, up to half of the children die before the age of 10.
That's mostly because of disease and malnourishment. Wheeler's nonprofit, the Tarahumara Relief Fund, is modest, but sometimes gets a lucky donation from a big company or a foreign embassy. Then there's this unexpected bonus. Wheeler picked up a protege. You're listening to him play now. He's the first of Wheeler's 46 godsons, all native Tarahumara. His name is Romeno Gutierrez. The tune he plays is a Tarahumara deer dance. My first memories are sitting at my godfather's piano, Gutierrez says. He was just 5 then. His feet couldn't reach the pedals below. Today, he's 29 and studies music in college. This summer, Gutierrez will tour Europe for the 3rd time alongside his godfather. I want to continue in the footsteps of my godfather, he says. I want to help my community with music. For the world, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in Mexico's Copper Canyon.
Okay, if you still think this is an April Fool's gag, we've got visual proof that it's not. Photos of the whole setup are on our Tumblr, including the view from Romaine Wheeler's piano bench into the bottom of the canyon. What a life. You can see those pics at pritheworld.tumblr.com. And that'll do it for us today. Our theme song was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.